I'm delighted now to welcome back to the show Marcela Diaz. She's executive director of Somos Un Pueblo Unido, and Amy Villarreal, who is research fellow at Berkeley Law Center for Human Rights, or was last year, where she did the research for a new report called Bias-Based Policing at a Glance, which was published by Somos Un Pueblo Unido and the NAACP. Welcome, ladies, to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having us. Thank you.
So what is bias-based policing? Is that the same as racial profiling?
Well, a lot of people think that bias-based policing is racial profiling, but actually people can be singled out for a number of reasons, right? And so the importance of this law is that it takes into account kind of the nuances in that there's a lot of categories in which people can be singled out.
Like what?
Such as for their gender identity. After September 11th, your religion became a marker of criminality somehow. There's also, of course, national origin and language. People can be singled out. We've seen in our communities people being, put aside at DWI checks and asked about their immigration status just because they speak Spanish and they're perceived to be from somewhere else. So there's a lot of ways that people can be singled out, and race and ethnicity, you know, is just one of them.
Sometimes people are singled out for the bumper stickers on their car.
Exactly, and political affiliation is one of the categories that was expanded as well. Definitely there's a lot of different ways that people can be marked. But, you know, when we talk about bias-based policing or profiling, we're not talking about when, say, somebody has committed a crime and there is a profile, right? Or they're looking for somebody, they're investigating a crime, and the person that they're looking for has certain characteristics.
Right.
And so there's a profile of them, correct?
So there's a yellow man with orange hair.
Right.
That's not
carrying
right.
a briefcase.
Right.
Whatever it might be. That's not what we're talking about when we're talking about bias-based policing. We're talking about using certain categories that are supposedly associated with criminality, right, in some way, as the sole basis. You know, using these group characteristics as a sole basis for selection for some kind of investigatory activity, such as frisk or being stopped or whatever it might be.
I think that a lot of people, Mary Charlotte, also think of racial profiling and bias-based policing as getting stopped while black, you know, driving while brown,
right.
being stopped on a street corner just because of the way you look and because you might be speaking Spanish. And that is certainly one
that
aspect of racial
lot.
Profiling and bias-based policing. But the 2009 law that Somos Un Pueblo Unido worked with the NAACP, the Drug Policy Alliance, the Conference of Churches, a whole host of organizations, and in fact it was the NAACP that really spearheaded it, sort of goes beyond that, and it really delves into, you know, what is, it's not just the initial stop, because in some cases the initial stop is a valid stop, right? Mm-hmm. It's because a person was speeding or because a person is suspected of committing some either misdemeanor or whatever it is. So sometimes the stop can be valid, but it's beyond the initial stop. No one should feel like they are being treated disparately as a result of the language they're speaking, their bumper stickers on their car, whatever it is, you know, their LGBT status, their economic status, all of the different categories that this law actually covers. And so that's certainly what we're seeing in Somos. We're getting reports from around the state, most recently from San Juan County, that at a routine traffic stop, in many cases the stops were legitimate, went through a stop sign, didn't use a signal, etc., routine traffic stops, or through a DWI checkpoint, people, based on the color of their skin, or they think it's because it's based on the color of skin or the fact that they're speaking Spanish or because they speak with an accent. In some cases, the police officers have said, you know, you have an accent, where are you from? And then it changes the course of the questioning and the conversation and the search and the investigatory activity. And so this law makes it clear that law enforcement shouldn't be changing the scope of their investigation, their line of questioning, based on any of these factors. And that's exactly what we're seeing. In some cases, it turns into a prolonged detention at a DWI checkpoint. In other cases, it turns into a full-on deportation, because once they ascertain that a person is undocumented, even though that's a civil immigration infraction, and it's not a crime, they continue to hold them, and then they turn them over to the ICE, the Immigration Customs Enforcement Agency, and then that individual isn't arrested for the DWI. They're arrested because of their civil immigration status. And that's something that is definitely sending a chill through immigrant and non-immigrant communities in this area. And bias-based policing is not, and racial profiling, as many research has already shown, that it's not an effective way of policing, and it causes a great breach between vulnerable minority communities and law enforcement. And it's un-American, and it's wrong, and it's unconstitutional. And so we think having strict guidelines and practices and procedures and complaint procedures, all of that is meant to provide clear expectations, both in the law enforcement community and in the community itself, about what should be happening, what shouldn't be happening, how to complain about it. And that, when that starts to work, you can start to see good community police partnerships come out of that, and you don't have whole communities that are afraid of the police.
I think it cultivates not only fear but anger when you are stopped and you are treated differently than a white person. I mean, I was once talking to a friend of mine who's an older white guy, and he was speeding in a school zone in the morning, and a cop stopped him, and he said, "Oh gosh, I'm so sorry." And the cop said, "Oh, that's all right. You know, just don't do it again." And he said, "Boy, I got off easy because I'm an older white guy in a nice car." And when you think about the awareness that it took for him to say that, the flip side is he was grateful. The flip side is so many people have really just cause for that kind of anger, and you know that that kind of anger breeds bad things.
Right. Well, it certainly breeds resentment in the community, yeah, and an unwillingness. I mean, just 2 weeks ago, we worked with recently formed community group of immigrants and allies in Farmington in San Juan County, and they filed 6 racial profiling complaints or bias-based policing complaints under this law. And they will not call the police. This one woman told a story about her neighbor the battery was being stolen out of her neighbor's car. And the first call was to us, second call, and we said, "Well, call your neighbor, tell her," you know, because she was too afraid to call the police in that moment, because she said, "If the police come, they're going to ask me for my social security." It's standard practice with the San Juan County Sheriff to ask about immigration status, to ask about national origin, to turn people over to ICE. And she was just trying to be a good Samaritan. And so when you have that kind of relationship with your community, that bodes poorly for everyone's public safety.
Exactly.
Right. And, of course, studies have shown over and over again that profiling practices of this sort is just not good policing. You end up wasting a lot of time and resources singling people out that you're supposed to be criminal just based on, you know, certain characteristics, when in reality you should be investigating crimes. Right. So it's just not an effective policing practice. Furthermore, you open up the door to liabilities as people start complaining about these types of practices. So,
and if you have good complaint procedures in place, this is what I, you know, and it's, you should know that, or your listeners should know, Mary Charlotte, that when this law was passed in 2009, you know, it wasn't, it was a lot of compromise that had to happen in order for this law to get through, and it passed handily, yeah, in the end, and I think it passed unanimously in the House and with a very wide margin in the Senate. And you know, everyone came to the table, law enforcement officials and, you know, DAs and the Attorney General's office, and then a host of civil rights organizations and faith organizations like ours, community organizations like ours. And so, you know, basically the consensus was we need clear guidelines, we need clear standards, we need good measures of accountability. And that's exactly what we were trying to get to with this particular report. It's been 3 years since
this law went
into effect.
And the law bans racial profiling
and other forms of bias-based policing.
And
there were very clear requirements, very basic requirements in the law that all law enforcement agencies in New Mexico needed to be in compliance with by the end, by December 31st of 2009. And that was, you know, changing policies, making sure that they match the and coincide with the actual expansion within the law. I mean, these are expanded categories. When we think of racial profiling bans and policies around the country, and there are 23 states, we were the 23rd state to pass such a policy, they usually focus on race, color, ethnicity, in some cases religion. This really was an expansive list. And so because it's language, because it's political affiliation,
mental disability,
medical condition,
gender identity.
And yeah. So it sets those. So you have to. They had to have created policies that coincide with it. Train their law enforcement officials on those policies. Publish those policies. Make complaint forms if they didn't have them available to the public. And in our work, because we, you know, people from the immigrant community are constantly calling us about, from all over the state, we're a statewide organization, about what's happening in their communities and in issues that they're having with employers, law enforcement, et cetera. It was clear that there really still, 3 years later, weren't mechanisms through which individuals could complain and hold their law enforcement agencies accountable, which is why we were happy that Amy was interested in helping us figure out who's compliant, who's not compliant, and what needs to happen and for them, these agencies, to get in full compliance with this 2009 law.
We're talking about the report, Bias-Based Policing, by Amy Villarreal, so, and published by Somos Un Pueblo Unido and the NAACP. So you basically looked at agencies all over the state. How did you go about this? What agencies did you select? You wanted it to be fair. You wanted it to be statewide. Probably you couldn't go to every single agency in every single town in New Mexico. So how did you do the report?
Okay. Actually, it was conducted in two phases. The first phase looked at all of the agencies in the state of New Mexico, actually.
Oh, you did?
And there's 97 of them. And what we did is we collected their policy, if they had one, and also their complaint forms. And in the initial...
Which they were required to have by this time.
Which they were required to have by this time, right, and be updated in order to comply with the law. And we just did a basic kind of look, you know, review. I did a basic review of these policy documents, and I looked for two criteria. Did they have a clear definition of what counts as bias-based policing? And did they include all of the categories that were expanded in the law, which was really important? And so,
have there been complaints about, for example, somebody who has a turban or some kind of head scarf on, that being discriminated against, things like that?
Well, what's interesting, I also asked if they had received any complaints, especially the ones that were, well, at least the ones that I selected out in the random sample, which is the second part of the study.
Yeah.
And most agencies said they had never received a complaint. And so,
well,
I'm,
if you don't have any complaint forms,
if you don't
forms,
have complaint forms, it might be the reason why, and if
right.
you don't have a policy. So actually, Santa Fe, which is our blue ribbon agency, who did, you know, has is completely in compliance with
they
the act.
They got an A.
They got an A, but they also had received two complaints. And so that makes me think, well, if you have knowledge, if the community has knowledge about what counts as bias-based policing, if they have access to complaint forms, that actually might facilitate, you know, being able to bring this to attention, right? And being able to complain and get some kind of resolution. And that's exactly what this law was intended to do. So in the first initial review, it was really dismal, the results. So it was only 50% of the agencies actually had a written policy at all.
Uh-huh.
And less than a quarter of those had those two basic criteria in place.
So why is compliance so low in New Mexico?
Well, from what I've found, it seems that most agencies just were confused, had either forgotten that this law had passed, weren't informed. If they were informed, that letter got lost in the mix. You know, a lot of agencies, especially small rural agencies, do not have a lot of staff, and so they were just kind of confused about what all of this was about. And but, you know, agencies that didn't have a policy at all, that's certainly a problem, because they should have had a policy even before this law was passed.
Right.
So, you know, that was kind of disconcerting. And then also that 19% of all of the agencies didn't have a policy. That's the 19%. And then about 24% just refused to provide the information. And that was also disconcerting because that's not only a violation of the Act, but also the Inspection of Public Records Act. And so anybody should be able to call these agencies and very easily receive this type of documents. They're public documents.
What were those interactions like? I mean, presumably you were the person making these calls and asking for this information.
Yeah, sometimes, people were very, friendly and they, offered the information right away.
But the ones who didn't.
But basically, across the board, people were very apprehensive. Once you start talking about profiling and about complaint forms, people are worried that you're the one complaining. And they get very apprehensive, very defensive. And it's just really interesting to see the reactions. And in some cases, it required up to 18 contacts to get the information. And in at least two or three cases, I went in person. Yeah. To the agencies. And
this is a person who speaks English well and who can, obviously an articulate person who's saying, I'm doing this as a research project.
Right.
And it requires 18 contacts. Imagine the person who is wanting to call and say, I had this issue happen to me just recently with one of your officers and I'd like to complain. And I can tell you, we were trying to get the complaint form recently from San Miguel County. And it was San Miguel County, I believe. And it was really, because we just were calling on behalf of someone else just to get the complaint form, because a lot of people don't want to do it directly. They want to go through Somos Un Pueblo Unido. They know that we're safe, that they can do it safely through our organization, which we welcome. We're more than happy to help people go through that process. And it was really interesting because it was whoever it was that answered the phone said, I need to talk to the person who wants to make the complaint. We said, well, that person isn't here. All we need is your policy and your complaint form so that we can help them fill it out. They said, if I can't talk to the person, this isn't going to get resolved and I'm not going to give you the information. I have to talk directly to the person. Now, that in and of itself is a violation of this law.
Right.
Because the law clearly states that a person can file a complaint by third party or can do it anonymously. And, of course, we know that the investigation isn't going to go as far as it could or should if a person decides to remain anonymous, but they still need to take the complaint. They still need to see, and the whole purpose of this is to see whether or not, we don't have data. We don't collect data of stops or arrests or things like that. And so this, in part, helps us figure out as a state, where is there either real profiling or even perceived profiling? Where would we perhaps put extra training resources? Where would we start these community dialogues? And if this front end of the process isn't working the way it's supposed to, it's just going to lead to a lot of problems and possibly lawsuits in the future. So we think that this is a good way to do it in an open, community-driven way.
And then there was a second part of the study, which is actually the report card. And people really honed in on it because people got grades. There's this whole mysticism around grades. People want a good grade.
Because we're all traumatized from our third grade report
cards. Right, exactly. So the case study, which comprises the first, New Mexico's first bias-based policing report card, took all of the criteria, every single standard that's included in the law, and did a random sample. We looked at 20 municipal agencies, 10 county agencies, and looked at their policies and tried to look for every single standard and if it was actually in place in their policy. And so the standards are listed in the report, and I probably shouldn't go through all of them, but they were quantified, and people were assigned a score and a letter grade. Well, not people, but the policy. The policy was actually given a grade. And so what that case study showed was that only two agencies were in full compliance with the law.
One of them being Santa Fe.
One of them being Santa Fe Police Department.
Police Department.
And the other, Socorro County Sheriff's Office. And so they were like the stellar organizations, right, that had the best policies. So it was pretty disconcerting, again, to see that the average score on this was a D.
So it really does highlight something that's very important across the board, not just with this issue, is just because you pass a law, that doesn't mean it's going to be enforced.
Absolutely.
I mean, here you are a student, and here you are, Marcela, running a private nonprofit organization, and you guys are enforcing the law, and the Who's supposed to do it? Was there any provision in the law for enforcement?
That's a great question. Actually, the Attorney General is the person who has oversight over this law. And we met last week before we released the report. Because he has oversight, we decided, and that's actually written into the statute, we decided that it was important that we meet with him first and give him this information and then release it to the public. So that's what we did. And I think he was very surprised. He had said that in this meeting we had a lot of folks from San Juan County and Veguita and Socorro County where they actually got an A. And then all of these statewide civil rights organizations, we met with him, talked about the results of the report. I think he was disturbed. And he pledged there to sort of move forward and really try to figure out why aren't these communities compliant. He said that he had sent a letter after the law had gone into effect, but that really no follow-up was done, clearly.
Yeah.
And so, you know, he said that he was going to put several people on his staff from different departments to see what was going on. He was particularly disturbed by the fact that people weren't even releasing information, because that's not just a violation of the law. It is a violation of the Inspection of Public Records Act.
Yeah.
And so he said he would sort of move forward. He also pledged to put some brochures together from his office talking about, you know, what containing all the information about the law and people's rights. He also said that he was going to start to receive complaints directly and have a couple of point people for both the public as well as law enforcement agencies. And I think it's important. We do, at Somos, file complaints and help folks file complaints because we think that those accountability is good. I mean, we're held accountable for our actions. We think that law enforcement should be as well, and that's how we're going to build a safer community for everyone. And we do want to make clear that although we do file a lot of complaints for folks with folks around the state, that this report, and I think that might have come out initially in the press as, you know, these are the folks who are engaging in bias-based policing. And that's not what this report does. It's a strict policy analysis of do they have the standard practices in place, the standard policies in place and procedures. And we would contend that having clear guidelines, clear policies in place, clear procedures, clear measures of accountability, that's going to lead to good practice in the field.
Even police, law enforcement agents and administrators agree with that fact. And that's what's so, which is really encouraging about this report, is the impact that it's had on individual agencies.
Already.
So, already.
Talk about that, because it really is very exciting.
It is very exciting. Los Alamos, I think it's Sergeant Foster, called me the other day and he said, you know, we got a B on the report, but we really want to have an A. We want to be A students. And I just wanted to let you know that we have fixed the areas in which lost points. And I just wanted to let you know that we, you know, wanted to be an A. We want to have an A. And so, and little communities all over the state are publishing articles about how their agencies are doing all over the state, which is also encouraging. And this is exactly kind of the impact we wanted this report to have, just to start that community dialogue, start educating people about the act and the problem of bias-based policing, and also have them start working with their agencies to either pressure them or help them become compliant. And that was the intention.
And you also shared best practices with and Santa Fe. You said Santa Fe City Police Department was one of the blue ribbon the blue ribbon community on this issue. And I was on a radio show recently with the spokesperson from the Bernalillo County Sheriff Department. And he said, you know, when I looked at it, I wasn't happy that we got a B, is what he said. He said, so in 5 minutes, I fixed what we needed to fix so that we also could be an A agency.
Yeah.
And he said, and then I looked at the recommendations and I looked at Santa Fe and I saw that, you know, Santa Fe provided their bias-based complaint forms in Spanish and English on their website. And he said, we don't have ours in Spanish, but we should. And so, and that's not even a requirement under the law.
Yeah.
But these civil rights organizations made a number of recommendations and in regards to this law. And one of them is, you know, if you have a large Native American community speaking a specific language in your community, perhaps you should have complaint forms available and policies in those languages or in Spanish or other. I mean, we're a multilingual state. And so if you have a large population in your community of a certain community, you should probably think about doing that. That's like one recommendation that we have, standard policies across the board, standard complaint forms. One of the things that we really like about Santa Fe's policies is that they not only have their regular citizen complaint form, but they have a specific bias-based policing complaint form where you can actually check. And it's not, that's good for our community, but it's also just good for law enforcement to sort of be able to weed out, does this person think that they've been discriminated against based on one of these factors, or is it a general complaint about, you know, officer rudeness, right? You're going to treat those complaints differently. So,
well, one of the things I wanted to ask you was, to what extent is there, do you think there's just plain old racial prejudice among police? And we know there is, and among at least some people. Does this kind of thing, does it actually mitigate their prejudice? Does it cause them to behave differently? Does it cause them to feel differently?
I think that when you have good, clear policies in place and good leadership and training on this, even if people still hold certain biases, you are able to mitigate those because you know that that's against the law and against, you know, what we're trying to do as police officers. And it's part of, you know, when we talked about to law enforcement administrators about this, they said it's more about leadership and actually training officers to do the right thing. And then also complaints actually help us kind of weed out those kinds of issues because officers will be disciplined. And then if you have certain agencies that keep getting complaints, there's oversight by the Attorney General because you're supposed to send all the complaints that the agency gets and how they were investigated to the Attorney General for oversight. And so if the Attorney General sees that there is a, you know, a proliferation, right, of complaints from a certain agency, then there can be an outside investigation. So I think that, you know, we can't really change the fact that right now, we're working on it, that we live in a racialized society and that bias exists at all levels and it's institutionalized. And when we talk about racial profiling, we're talking about something that's a plague within society and not necessarily an individual problem or a mental problem, but something that's institutionalized, and that's why it shows up in law enforcement. It shows up in the dropout rate in schools. It shows up in employment practices. And that's what we're talking about, the institutionalized racism.
And more obviously, I mean, it's not just the resentment that's built in that ends up surfacing in the community as a result of this. It really is. I mean, you see it in disparate arrest in arrest patterns.
Right.
Who ends up going to jail, who ends up getting convicted for minor drug violations. And so, I mean, it's a real problem that isn't just about people feeling like crap. Although that is a part of it. I mean, anyone who's been racially profiled, I've been profiled, and it really does feel terrible. it really does, and it does build resentment, and you feel powerless in that moment. And so,
but it tears apart families.
If it leads to deportation, which is the
crux
of the legal debate in Arizona right now, Sheriff Arpaio is being sued because people truly believe that in his quest to arrest people for having violated the law, the immigration laws, even though that's a civil issue, that in order to do that, he is engaging in broad, sweeping racial profiling practices. And so that's exactly what we're seeing in some communities in New Mexico. And this is just one way to chip away at the problem and to wrap our hands around the problem to really start to understand how it's happening. And the complaint process, I think, helps in the sense that, you know, even if individuals, it's found that it wasn't a racial profiling issue, I think that by an internal affairs investigation, for instance, even if the person is in discipline, I think that it helps spark that conversation within that agency. People feel a little bit more monitored, right? Mm-hmm. And that's really one of the things that we think is important. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to give you an example. It's an example that happened here in Santa Fe in our A agency, right? It wasn't our A agency that engaged in this. But, you know, there was a DWI checkpoint, and a person came a couple of weeks later to our office who is a member of our organization. And he just really wanted to come and say, this happened to me. And it didn't result in deportation or anything, but I really didn't like that it happened to me. It really felt terrible, and I wanted to complain. And is there any way that I can do anything about this. And he didn't want to sue. He didn't want to, he just wanted to be heard, and he just felt like this was not supposed to be happening in a place like Santa Fe. It was a joint DWI checkpoint between the local law enforcement agencies and state law enforcement agencies. And your listeners might remember that the governor, on day 31 of her tenure as governor, issued an executive order mandating that all state police ask about immigration status of quote-unquote criminal suspects. Now, her office says that it's only people who were arrested, but the actual executive order says criminal suspects. Well, criminal suspect can be anyone, right? It's a very broad and vague term. And we're seeing that as a result of that, a lot of folks are being asked about their immigration status who are not criminal suspects. And in this case, it was an individual who was driving through a DWI checkpoint. Now, have you ever been through a DWI checkpoint?
Yeah.
And I don't know if you drink or not, but, you know, you go through and it should take, you know, 10 seconds.
Less
unless,
than a minute.
Unless, you know, slurred speech. I mean, there are a lot of indicators that perhaps you are breaking the law. And if you're not, and in this case this gentleman was not, then, you know, it should be a very quick and swift process. And he was asked, well, where are you from? Well, I live in Santa Fe. Where are you from originally? I'm Mexican. And he said, well, can you prove that you're, this was a state police officer, can you prove that you're legally in this country? So this guy knew his rights. He said, well, why do I have to do that? That's not what this is about. But he ended up getting detained for about 5 minutes in this process, engaged with this law enforcement official, who didn't end up doing anything. You know, he ended up eventually letting him go. But again, that's a process. You know, if a person knew that this was happening, or if our community knew that this was happening consistently, as it is in San Juan County, people are going to be afraid to leave their houses at night, right? and that's certainly something that we don't want. And so in that case, he said, I really feel like, he asked me if I was Mexican. I don't know why he asked me if I was Mexican. I speak with a very thick accent. He said, my English is limited. He said, and I think it really was terrible that I had to be there for 5 minutes justifying who I am, what I'm doing here, I was driving to the freeway. And unfortunately, what ends up happening is that that's not our city police department's policy. It was the state police department's, if not policy, practice in that moment. And it's going to be hard to distinguish at some point which agency did what, right? And then that's why it's so important that we have these standard policies in place across the board. Because what one agency is doing might undermine what another agency is trying to do.
And also, you know, with that executive order, it seems to actually mandate racial profiling, in effect, because it's saying every criminal suspect is going to be asked about their immigration status. Well, how do you determine who to ask that unless we are asking everyone that question?
And surely they're not asking everyone that question.
And surely they aren't.
Right.
So obviously there's a selective process in which certain people are asked those kinds of questions and certain people aren't. And how do you make that assessment? People's language, people's race, people's color.
And that's exactly is against the law under this 2009
So it's very contradictory.
Prohibition.
Amy Villarreal is the author of the report Bias-Based Policing at a Glance. She did the research when she was a fellow at Berkeley Law Center for Human Rights, and the report is published by Somos Un Pueblo Unido and the NAACP, and Marcela Diaz is executive director of Somos Un Pueblo Unido. Very, very important stuff. Thank you so much for being with us and for talking about it.
Thanks for having
Thank
us.
Thank you.
I'd like now to welcome back to the program Angela Gabriel. She's the education and outreach director for the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival. She's a percussionist. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, thanks.
It's lovely to have you back, and we're always talking about music in one way or another, and the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival is an amazing institution, and they have, among other things, youth concerts, which you were working on not only doing but telling people about.
Yes.
What's going on?
Well, we have a series of 5 concerts. 2 of them have already happened. And the third one is going to be on Friday, August 3rd at 10 a.m. This will be the percussion concert, which I'll actually be playing as well as introducing. And then we have August 9th at 2 is the string sextet, 2 violas, 2 violins, 2 cellos. And then Saturday, August 18th at 10 a.m., now this one's in the Lenzic. The others are St. Francis Auditorium at the Museum of Art. But this one's in the Lenzic. Really fun Tiempo Libre. which is a 3-time Grammy-nominated Cuban timba group.
Yes, indeed. I will be there.
Yeah, it's going to be a blast. And they also, they're very active in their education and outreach. And so they're really great with kids, and they're going to have quite a show for the kids. And these are all free, too, by the way.
Oh, they are?
Yeah. And so not only are they free, but we give away things to the kids when they come to the shows. So we have little passports that they take, and we stamp the passport every time they come. And then after they get 3 stamps, they get free Häagen-Dazs ice cream on the plaza. And then after 4 stamps, they get a whole bag full of swag. Like, we used to give T-shirts, but this year we're doing those backpacks, those real cool backpacks. And they have little rubber bracelet and some erasers and some, I won't even give it all away, but
lots
some fun
of good
stuff.
Yes. So it encourages them to go to multiple concerts. Well, let's talk about the percussion concert in which you're playing. What kind of groups, what kind of music are we talking about?
Well, we have 5 players, and we've all been playing together. Some of us have been playing together for about 25 years, and they're all the opera percussionists. It's kind of an interesting concept for us every year, because usually these youth concerts are groups that are also performing a regular concert, and then they just take excerpts from the concert that they're going to do and kind of tailor that to children to make it fun and interactive for them. It's kind of rare that they have a percussion concert. It's been a few years since we've done an actual, like, I hate to say real, but adult concert for the Chamber Music Festival. And so usually when we get together to do this, we have to kind of tailor it to the fact that we're not going to have a lot of instruments, and our resources are different because we're not already doing a concert for the adults. And so it's really fun for us to try to come up with ways to show the kids a lot of different percussion styles, cultures, techniques, and different kinds of pieces, but not have a lot of big equipment on the stage.
So you've got 5 percussionists, and are you going to be, I mean, what kind of music are you going to be playing? Are you going to be playing pieces for 5 percussion instruments?
Yeah, we're playing chamber music. Some of it, there's one piece that's a trio that actually we performed it as part of the New Music Festival that happened about a month ago.
Right.
And that was the premiere of the piece, and so we'll do that one again.
What are the instruments?
Marimba, vibraphone, drum set, and here I just said we're not using big instruments, and they're big instruments, but yeah. But we'll actually have the marimba already there because one of the players will be using it on a different piece with other people, and so it was kind of cool that we can use the marimba this time. Usually we don't have big stuff like that on stage when we do these kids' shows, but that piece is it's pretty cool. We all have our big instrument plus lots of little things. Break drums and glass, and then we'll do a piece that's just 5 clave players by Steve Reich called Music for Pieces of Wood.
Oh my goodness.
And that's really fun. That's always kind of a hit, that piece. And then we usually try to do some kind of story. This year our story is going to be the actual piece of music itself is the story. It's a piece by John Cage. And as percussionist, John Cage is a real important part of of everything in percussion, our philosophy, our music.
How so?
Well, he really changed the idea of what is music, and what are legitimate instruments that you can use to play. The piece we're doing is called Living Room Music. And so you can use anything from a sofa on the floor or a phone book, anything that you'd find in your house.
Oh, so we're not talking about the rhythms being dramatically transformed, but the instruments themselves.
Yes and yes. Yeah, he transformed the rhythms as well. I mean, he does a lot of really interesting rhythmic things that before Cage came along, you didn't necessarily hear a lot of people doing, where you have, say 13 notes in the place of 2, and while you're doing that, someone else is playing 7 notes in the place of 2, and then someone else is doing 3, and then they all come down together on the next downbeat. So think interesting things like that,
yeah,
he does. But it's really more about his philosophy really changed. I mean, you're probably familiar with his piece 433, which is just 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence.
Yeah, I think that's probably the most famous John Cage piece.
Which actually is written for a pianist.
Yeah, but, right. Who doesn't play the piano.
Right, who just sits
just
there.
Just sits there.
But he does have a really cool piece that we're not doing this time, but We've done movements from this in the past. He has a piece called Amores, which is has a couple movements for prepared piano. And I played that back when we were in college with some of these people that will be playing on this concert too. And so he even transformed that, you know, just the idea of what is an instrument supposed to sound like and what is a, quote, good sound, you know, and changed my whole philosophy from it's not about a good or a bad sound, it's about your choice. What's your musical choice? And so as percussionists, that's what we do. We're making choices constantly about we'll walk through Home Depot and say, which bucket do we want to play? Which one sounds better to us for this piece?
You right.
know, or which clay pot? Or, you know.
I knew somebody once who was working in a travel agency in Cusco, Peru, and a group of Brazilians came in, and one of them dropped a coin by mistake, and he liked the sound of it, so he dropped it again. Mm-hmm. And somebody turned over a wastebasket and started playing percussion along with the sound of the dropping coin. And then somebody else started singing, and somebody else started dancing, and all the Peruvians joined in, and they had a big party and closed the travel agency and sang and danced for the rest of the afternoon.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And I thought, that's something that's never going to happen anywhere in the United States of America.
Well, you know, maybe not, but I disagree. I think that kind of thing happens all the time, especially with percussionists. And that's part of, this kind of gets to the other thing we were going to talk about, the Music in the Brain Symposium. Part of what I was going to be doing in the offering that I'm part of, we're talking about the idea of some people who can hear a beat and some people who can't, and how you have percussionists who you might sit there at a traffic light and you're looking at all the different blinkers going at different rates, and it makes music to people who are picking up on those kinds of things. And also John Cage, he changed all those things. You know, just the fact that you can sit outside and listen to the sounds as they happen, and that actually is the music, as compared to maybe taking a sound that a coin dropping on the floor and saying, that's music. Let's use that in this piece.
We're talking to Angela Gabriel about the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival and the various events that are going on there. Now, the Music in the Brain, which we're hoping to talk to some people about later on this week, what's that all about? It's a symposium, I think a very interesting and important symposium that's happening this weekend in which you are taking part.
Yes. Yeah, I am really excited about this. It's August 4th through 6th, and they have some really amazing scientists and musicians coming in. The person that I'm working with, his name's Ani Patel. He works at the Neurosciences Institute in San Diego. And he's doing actually several things in this symposium, but the thing that he and I are doing together is Sunday, August 5th from 3:30 to 4:30, and it's specifically about music and the mind, the brain and rhythm, and how are we unique as a species that we can feel the beat, or do we share that with other animals, you know, and also how does it work? Is it a specific function of the brain, or...
And what's the verdict?
The verdict is that we are not unique in feeling a beat, but it's not what you would think. It's not actually because our brain has evolved in a certain way. You would think if we could feel a beat, then maybe primates could too. But in study after study, they don't show that they can feel a pulse. The closest that they could get with primates was they could get them to react to a beat right immediately after the beat happened. They might move.
They could imitate it.
Yeah, but if you're actually anticipating a beat, if you're feeling a pulse and you know that there's another one coming, you're more likely to be early than you are to be late. And so what they found is that music and the beat is more related to language. And so animals that have the capability to make sounds and repeat those sounds and use those sounds as a way to communicate are more likely to have rhythm than animals that don't. So a bird, a cockatoo, in fact, Ani has done many studies with a cockatoo named Snowball, can feel the pulse, and he bobs his head to the pulse no matter what the pulse of the music is. It could be a really fast pulse, or you could take the same song and slow it down digitally, and he'll bob his head in relationship to that pulse.
Now, is there any relationship between, for example, horses have different gaits? Then we were just talking the other day on the radio to some people who play cowboy music, and how cowboy music is written, a lot of it to either a kind of ambling walk or a trot or a gallop, and those are the rhythms of a lot of these songs. Mm-hmm. And it makes me wonder when you're talking whether horses who have those rhythms so deeply built into them can also somehow feel them in the way that you're talking about?
That's a good question. I think that a lot about people too, because I, you know, as a teacher, I've had a lot of people say, "Oh, I have no beat. I have no rhythm. I can't play music at all." Yet they walk. You know, if you're walking, you have a certain rhythm that's happening. If you're skipping, it's a different rhythm. If you're jumping rope, it's a different rhythm. So we perform these things every day that require a certain rhythm. Even brushing your teeth requires a certain rhythm. But I think that people are more likely to say that they don't have rhythm based on other things, not the physical coordination. I think, you know, we all, even if you're walking with a limp, you're still making a rhythm. You're still creating a pattern, and there's a beat to it.
It's also interesting because there are people who are amazing percussionists, but then when they try to learn to dance, they're kind of starting all over again, and to get the rhythm in their feet as well as in their hands, it's almost like a new part of the brain.
You know, that's interesting that you're saying that, because that's a big part of what Ani and I think what we'll focus on. We're getting together on Friday just to confirm all this stuff. We've been communicating over email, and so I'm real excited because I don't even really know what all is going to happen. But part of it, I'm going to have a drum set. And I've been a percussionist for many, many years, but I've always been a classical percussionist. And so I always considered myself a percussionist and not a drummer. And I was kind of afraid of the drum set. You know, I'd sit down and I'd be like, what's the music say to do? I don't know what to do. You know, what? Here, you take the sticks. And so in the last, like, 3 years or so, I started playing drum set. And I'm having a blast. I mean, it's really fun to be able to express myself with that. But I'm going through that same learning curve of I really feel a groove, but I can't necessarily always make my body react the way I want it to, because you have to train. You have to practice moving your muscles in a specific way to make them react the way you want them to. And so I'm actually experiencing a lot of those things that you're talking about, like drummers trying to dance. But yeah, you see that a lot. It's funny. It's like in the drumming world, you have your professional kind of classically trained percussionists who generally they read what the page says, and they're really good at counting, and they're really good at listening, but they don't really groove in terms of they're not going to get together with friends and just kind of jam, usually. And then on the other hand, you have your, like, drum circle drummers, people who aren't really educated in music. They just play because it feels good. And so they're playing these grooves with each other, and they don't necessarily know what it is they're doing. They just feel what they're doing. But then there's a like, you have your percussionists who play really tight, and then your drum circle drummers who play loose and free and relaxed, but it's not necessarily, like, precise. And it's kind of rare to find somebody who bridges those two worlds. And that's something that I've tried to do. As a player who played mostly what was on the page, I really had this longing in me. I really wanted to try to jam, you know. And, in fact, that's part of why I moved to Santa Fe, was to play in the marimba community and to be able to just kind of get off the page and just jam with people. And so as drummers, sometimes it's really hard for drummers to let go and just groove. And I think that that's something that that we might not take into consideration when we're talking about do we have a beat or not, because there's so many emotional and psychological things. It's not just how do you hear it, how do you feel it, how do you coordinate it. It's also what do you believe that you can do. And you know, it goes so far beyond.
Angela Gabriel is the Education and Outreach Director for Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival. She's a percussionist, and for more information, you can just go to your computer and Google Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival. Lots of good things happening, including Friday morning at 10 o'clock at the St. Francis Auditorium. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.